It takes 10 years for me to actually do an interview with the Dirty Nil, and I've been a big fan of this band since the first time I saw them and heard them way back in the day. Three-piece out of Dundas, Ontario, and they rock. It's anthem rock. It's fun rock. They put on an amazing live show. They make me laugh, and it's just awesome that I get a chance to talk with Luke after all of these years. So sit back, relax, get to know the Dirty Nil, their music, how it started, antidotes, positivity, keeping focus, and all those wonderful things. All of that in the next couple hours. Yeah, it's a couple hours. It's a lot of music and some cool banter from Luke. Not so much me. Here's Luke from the Dirty Nil. Hey, joining me right now is a gentleman via Zoom who I assume is tired of doing Zoom interviews, just like the rest of us in society over the last 2 years. Luke Bentham from the Dirty Nil. Hi, buddy.
How's it going?
I'm good. I got to tell you, this has been this has been like 10 years in the making, this chat.
Yeah.
It's kind of embarrassing a little bit for me, because over the last 10 or 11 years since you guys been around, I would constantly say either something horrible about you on the air, making fun of you, telling you that I was secretly in love with the band. And I had all this, and I said that you guys were pretty much the saviors of rock and roll for me over the last 10 years. And I know it's, you don't tell people that, you don't say crap like that on the air, but I couldn't help myself, because whenever I played the band or I witnessed the band, I went, oh my God, you don't want to follow that on stage. You just don't want to do it, you know, and that was playing into my own years of seeing bands go up on stage and looking at their shoes while they played. Whereas when I saw you guys off the skip, it was like, they're going to break something. Oh, something's going to get broke for sure, man. You know, so that was my weird adulation I had for the Dirty Nil.
Well, that is sick, and I appreciate the suspiciously warm intro very much. So, yeah. I mean, that's a very, very high compliment to pay. I mean, we've always just tried to make the goal of it to have fun. Basically, I mean, as cheesy as that is, like, you know, we did it because I think the other thing too is that we kind of joined a scene when we were in our early 20s, I guess, but
you were in your early 20s.
Came from Dundas, so there wasn't a whole lot of bands kicking around Dundas for us to learn from.
The thing about the Dirty Nil, though, I didn't know you guys were in your 20s. I thought you were a little bit younger. Like, I thought you guys were like 19, 18. I guess it's like early 20s. It's around the same thing. But you guys, to me, you guys just came off like you just did 52,000 all ages shows in one day. Like, you know, that youthful energy that you see when you see a band, you're like going, holy crap. Like what's like, how much are you guys in love with this? Like, cause every note, every lick, everything in the stage was like, it was just like this sort of like exuberant chaos when I first saw you guys.
Well, yeah, I think, depending on when you first saw us, like, well, we started the band, Kyle and I, in 2006. So we were 16.
Yeah.
Just turned 16, and yeah, we still have it now. So, but I mean, in and amongst that time, obviously, like, we didn't get cooking when we were 16, we were still in high school. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we were the first YouTube generation, and we learned about rock and roll from YouTube, and, you know, we gravitated towards bands that could really bring it on video and not just as you said, stare at their shoes. So
bands that could bring it, does that when you talk about the YouTube, is that your introduction to like bands like the Replacements or even local dude, you know, Mike Treblecock, who you learned guitar from at a young age? He was your guitar instructor. Bands like the Killswitch, that kind of stuff, is that what you learned off of YouTube, like that style of music, the Replacements, all that kind of stuff? Husker
well
Dude?
my my entry point to like music proper, I would say was definitely Nirvana. And it was like, when I was 11 or like turning 12, they dropped that song, You Know You're Right. And it was on, Much Music, like heavy rotation.
Yeah.
And I remember watching it one morning before school, like that excellent propaganda video of a music video they have for that song. And, kind of lionizes Kurt Cobain. And I remember like watching that and my parents were like, just kind of, my parents were not having the brash sound that was coming out of the TV that early before they had to go to work. And I remember being kind of like taking note of how much they disliked the music that was being played. And I just thought, well, I have to look into this more then. But I mean, I have to give a lot of credit to Mike Treblecock for teaching me about rock and roll. I mean, like when I first got a guitar, my godfather gave me my first guitar. It was a Squire Stratocaster. And I phoned up looking for guitar lessons in Dundas, our little town, and Avalon Music Academy was the first in the phone book.
Right.
And I phoned them up, and first guy I talked to was Steve Parton, rest in peace, who owned Academy. Lovely, lovely, absolute gem of a human being. I wish they made more like him. And he said, well, do you want to learn more like classical guitar or like, I remember exactly what he said. He said, or like Black Sabbath, Green Day. I'm like, definitely the second one. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to put you in with Mike Treblecock. And I remember meeting Mike and I was like this tall, you know, I was like a little munchkin. Yeah. And I brought my giant Squire Stratocaster in there and he tuned it up. And I was still playing with my thumb then because we didn't even have an internet connection or anything. I was just trying to like learn how guitar worked with my thumb. And Mike said, well, listen, I'm not going to tell you how to do your style, but I recommend you use a pick. So he showed me how to hold a pick. And then as I slowly, you know, crawled tooth and nail up the hill of you know, beginner's competency, then I started to get into like, you know, louder and louder music. And Mike showed me The Replacements and that changed my life. Mike showed me Pavement. Anything I would bring in, he would be super enthusiastic to teach me. He's still been trying to teach me theory for like 20 years, but I'm very resistant to that. I owe a lot to Mike. Mike, I could tell when I first started working with him, and learning from him that he had just gotten out of the Killjoys or they were just winding down. And looking back, I can tell that he probably had some, I don't think that it necessarily left him in a positive state of mind about how things kind of came to a conclusion with the band and his time in that kind of industry at that time. But what I will always credit Mike with was that he never ever let even a glimmer of that feeling into the lesson room when he was teaching me guitar. Never let any, you know, and I can't pretend to fully understand where his head was at, but you know, just from my own time in the industry, I can imagine, and just kind of also knowing what the music industry was in the late 90s and early 2000s, and being signed to a major label like they were, I can understand that there was, that there must have been some feelings that were not necessarily all positive. And as I said, Mike was just everything that a true teacher should be. He was enthusiastic and extremely positive. And, you know, if I had somebody that maybe wore their feelings on their sleeve a bit more, and again, not to project or to infer anything that I don't have any evidence for, but if I would have had a more negative teacher, I don't know if I would be doing this.
Lonely in the game when I ain't no lie.
Especially about art and music and crushing people's dreams, really. Because I find that now, as I get older, that I don't, when someone, someone from the younger generations plays me something, they go, well, what do you think of this? I pick the positives out of it. You know, if it's, even if it's not up to par, I go, okay, well, you know, what you guys have done here is really good. Here's some solid points in there that you should work on. But let's work on the actual recording process. Let's find a way of going in a studio and having someone help you along to make it a little bit better than what it can be before you start soliciting this material to others, right? Because you always want to put your best foot forward.
Of course.
And you know, and over the years I've learned that just because things didn't work out for me and I have like this this knowledge of negativity of things that have stifled myself or others around me, it's a terrible thing to put that on someone who is learning their way and wanting to like make something of and to be creative. You never want to stifle creativity like that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And you know, also to Mike's credit, like I would bring in some like drop D new metal bullshit and he'd tune down his Yamaha acoustic and be like, all right, I'll show you how to play this. Like, he kept his kind of, he checked his taste at the door and would teach me whatever I was enthusiastic about. That being said, if I did bring in cool shit, he'd be like, okay, let's definitely learn this. Like,
That goes without saying though.
I could tell his poker face would fade a little bit and you could see a genuine spark in his face when I bring in like, can you show me how to play Bastards of Young or something? But yeah, I mean, Mike showed me the Replacements and the Replacements are my favorite band of all time. So, I mean, them and the Who like are kind of neck and neck depending on the day.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was just an incredibly important for me looking back to have Mike as a teacher.
That's having all of those things earlier on in your career, excuse me, and moving along now to the stage that you're in now with the Dirty Nil. How does that, obviously you still try to keep those positive things, feedback to others that come up to you. Because I see it now with the other bands, and I remember over the years that whenever I was, because I used to be the tour manager for the Killjoys and do all the music stuff, there would always be a young band coming up going, can we open up for you? Can we do this? Can we do that? Can we do this? And you try to help them, but you can't have them on the bill all the time. How do you deal with that now? Or is that just something you just say, well, here's Dynalone's or I should say our manager's, you know, number, this is the promoter, that sort of thing. Or do you still have a say?
You know, we do what we can, like, and I'm always trying to remind myself of what it was like, you know, when we were 17 and we just made our first EP that we're incredibly proud of. And we were, you know, spamming people, like trying to get shows. And, you know, not to go off into the weeds, but I remember like we had just gotten our first master copy, like CD of our first EP that we made. And this is in, I guess, the beginning of 2008. and I saw we went and saw the Foo Fighters, and I had this CD because I just come from the studio, and I saw outside Ian and John from Billy Talent, and I was like, oh my god, this is so serendipitous, here, you got to take this thing. And I was, and they very graciously took it, but I kind of, in my, you know, 17 year old you know, just like idealism, was like, we're gonna get a call, it's all gonna happen. And you know, it just doesn't quite work that way, you know, like we didn't quite get a call. And I don't blame them for that, because I can't even imagine how inundated they are with people's demos and all that shit. But I mean, fast forward 9 years, and we're like playing in European arenas with them. So, you know,
that's got to be weird. I don't, you know, I mean, you tell the story and we know that you did it, but it still has to be a weird feeling of starting out, learning, playing, and doing all the shows. And then all of a sudden there is this, like, you're actually in Europe playing with like super huge bands. I mean, did you not open up for The Who at one point?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. It's on my birthday. It's great.
On your, like, so that's gotta be like, you kind of sit back and go, how did this happen? Like, what's going on?
Well, it's like life works for everybody. You know, I think it does take conscious energy to push. Like, I think my brain works, I would say, in a similar way to most people, where when good things happen, you say, yes, this good thing happened, but you got to remember the you know, the nullifying context that it occurred in, and these kind of detract from it. And yes, we got to do this, but all these negative things happen around it, and you have to force yourself to see the positive. But those kinds of events require zero reframing at all. It's like, we're playing with the fucking Who. This is the best day ever.
Yeah. That's like that kind of justifies all the incredible crappy drives, even though I love them.
Yes. I mean, like, there's always something, like, there's like, it's very easy to gravitate towards and stare at the negatives in life. That's how life works, you know. But it's much more productive to focus on the positive things that are happening, obviously. But yeah, in terms of like helping out younger bands, like, I, you know, obviously every band has to keep that soft spot for what it's like when you're trying. But that being said, like, you have to carve your own path at the same time. Like, I remember all the people that were really nice to me when we were kids and gave us opportunities, but you can put a young band on a really enthusiastic band on a bill, but if they can't, if it's just a kind of a single opportunity, they have to earn those fans themselves. Even when they get up on that stage, they got to be good. And so there's like, I think, you know, there's no substitute for like getting better and being a good band and making good songs and good recording and putting on a good show. That's kind of how I see it. Not to be too reductionist about it, but.
cards around because I don't care, but we'll see.
You go down to Philly, you go down to the States, and you play all these shows. But I always find it interesting when I ask an artist, at what point when you were on the stage, did you kind of look at each other and go, you know what, this just might work out. I think we're going to be all right. Or are you still waiting for that moment?
I think it's kind of like, I don't know, like you have those kind of glimpses of like where you definitely can appreciate that you've, you know, ascended at least some height of on the limitless mountain. Like the first time I think we sold out the Casbah Lounge, Kyle and I looked at each other like, damn, dude, there's 100 people here.
Yeah.
They each paid $8. It's crazy. So, I mean, there's those moments for sure. But I think, as with all things in all parts of life, that there's never a kind of like final feeling of accomplishment. It's always kind of, I think you got to kind of keep pushing towards the next thing. And I think that's how we're wired. Is you have to appreciate when like, fuck yeah, it all worked out. This is amazing. This is certainly a pretty good indicator that things are going well, but also like, what's the next thing? What's our next project that we're working on? That's kind of how it works for us. Like, but that's not to say that we certainly stop and smell the roses as much as possible.
So you're the way the Dirty Nil works is that it's always like, if we're not writing, if we're not recording, we're working on a video, or what's the next idea in social media to push us to gain further fans or further notice, that sort of thing. It's like, is that how it's, is that the jibber jabber in your brains where it's like, okay, well, we've done this, and this. The next 3 months, we have to do this, and this. Will we do a commercial? Will we try to get some of our music on a soundtrack of a movie? Is it always that for you guys?
Yes. There is certainly no rest for the wicked. We can play a huge sold out show and, you know, it'll be awesome. And I mean, the way my brain works is that like the next day, even though I'm really tired, I'll go down to our practice space and start writing more songs or trying.
Right.
I've learned from my time in this industry to never take your foot off the gas ever. It's kind of like, I don't know. I think like also the pandemic has kind of highlighted that there are no guarantees. So it's very important to just keep working and keep, because it's fun. Like Steve Albini said, the reward for hard work is more hard work. The reward for good work, I think, is more good. I don't know, something to that effect. Like
the reward is the opportunity to just keep going.
Yeah,
really,
partially for sure. It is not lost. I mean, we've in our 16 years as a band, like, you know, I'm sure you can imagine how many bands that we've played with and been friends with that like, and like 98% of them don't exist anymore.
Yeah. They just break up. They disappear for one reason
away.
Or another. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that,
they all become real estate agents or whatever.
Oh, what a painful thing. I'm sorry. Anyone I know who's a real estate agent.
No shade on anybody that's a real estate agent.
No, it's just between the thing I like about Facebook is like, I like to keep tabs on everyone, but I don't want to go to a showing. I just don't want to look through a house I can't afford and crush my dreams. Just don't want to do it. Thank you very much.
The hustle is real.
You said something interesting earlier about, okay, I'm exhausted. I'm tired. We did this great show. And I go down into the basement. I'm like, okay, well, I'm just going to like doodle around, maybe write some thoughts down or play a lick. But to me, how does that start for you guys as the Dirty Nil? You band 16 years. It starts out, did it start out with Luke sitting by himself writing lyrics, or did it start with a guitar lick? And has it changed from, I did this thing on stage I really enjoyed doing, I'm going to take that lick and then write a song around it? How does it work for you guys?
Well, I mean, it's definitely changed over time. And, you know, the band started because my parents got a Mac computer for Christmas 2015, I think it was, or maybe it was 2016. And when we got that, or sorry, 2006 rather, damn, long time ago, 2005 or 2006, I can't quite remember, but we got a Mac computer, and with my godfather, who, as I said, got me my first guitar, he bought us an interface, and GarageBand came stock on it, and I just kind of started like writing music in the loosest possible sense of the term, like in GarageBand, and I found it just completely electrifying. And then I was best friends with Kyle, so I was like, yo, Kyle, check this out, like I have this song. And Kyle's like, okay, let's play it. So then we played it, and then like I just kind of kept trying things in GarageBand, and then it moved from like, I basically stopped using GarageBand altogether, and then would sometimes just like go and Kyle would play a cool drum thing, and then I would write some guitar to it and write some vocals. And then sometimes, a lot of the time it's like, I write the first draft of the song. Like I write the chords, the guitar parts, and then like at least a sketch of the vocals or a chorus. And then I'll play it with Kyle and kind of, Kyle has a very specific drum style that I find very inspirational to play with. I think it's because like Kyle loves rap music so f- that he plays drums kind of like that. And he has, I mean, he's always kind of like learning new things and trying new things. But I think that, you know, we have a unique once in a lifetime musical chemistry together when it comes to, at least like, I've never felt like the joy of music with anybody else. And I've played in other bands and I've played with other people independently, but Kyle is like, I feel like we're 16 all the time still when we play together, you know.
That's what more could you ask for? Because that's inspiration. That's your genesis of your, when you got, we're really getting into something. And why would you ever want to lose that feeling?
Well, in any scenario? Perish the thought of losing that feeling.
But we were just saying earlier when we started chatting that, you know, that there are things that beat you down in life, right? So like, even when you just said, you know, here's Mike from the Killjoys coming off the end of you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, shutting things down. And, you know, there could be a point where he doesn't want to be creative anymore, that sort of thing. And to keep that feeling of being a 16-year-old, the exuberance, I think is perfect, what you were just talking about. And you would hear that through your albums as well. You know, when I go back and I listen to stuff, and I always enjoy playing the covers. I remember I took some flack years ago. I don't know how many years ago, but I went back on the air after a while, and I just played the Dirty Nil for a whole hour. That was it. I just went, this is what you're going to listen to for this hour. I played cuts off of what was out at the time. And I got some messages, and they're like, what are you just playing this for? How come you're not playing the rest of Hamilton music? There's a lot of Hamilton music. Like, I play Hamilton music for 30 years. For this 1 hour, I'm going to indulge you in something I think you should listen to because it's a lot of fun. Like, just, I was challenging the listener. Listen to this. It's okay. We don't have to have multi different songs from different artists in this. You can enjoy and find some enjoyment in this. Other people loved it. I remember even reading on Twitter that people were like, oh, no, this is great. You know, Dirty Nil, that sort of thing. I think even the band acknowledged, like, somebody's playing an hour up at 101.5. when it was called the Hawk, I think a couple of years ago. But those are those kind of things that when you go back and you listen to those albums and you spin them and as a listener, I always think if I wrote that and I was in a studio and I fought for that song to get on the album and then I played it on stage and the audience didn't get it, I think I'd be crushed. Like, are there songs that you fought for where you're like going, this is the song that's going to be great. And then it just got this like flat reaction. But then years later, you play it again and everyone's like going, hey, that's fantastic.
If I'm being completely truthful, I mean, I think I have at this point now, like when I write a song, I know whether it's a f-ing banger or not. I really am not surprised much anymore in terms of if I'm really happy with a song, it's usually going to go over really well.
Right.
There's other, like there's mitigating, and that's just like, I'm not to sound arrogant, but that is, you know, typically if I say this, like it's clear to all in the room with which ones are like, this one's good. Really? This one's a cut above the other ones. And so I've never had some sort of like jet, and they're all kind of like, it's like power pop with melodies and somewhat humorous lyrics. Like I think that there are definitely things that I think are kind of somewhat like, I'm a little less like, yeah, whatever, that song's like, whatever. And people really like those songs sometimes. But yeah, I mean, once in a while you're kind of like, yeah, this song's going to be like real, like, this one, I, you know, it's really slamming. And then it's kind of like, yeah, that one's pretty, like people kind of, they're like, it's not bad, but it's not like my favorite one for the record. So there's a little bit of that, but I think that the general kind of surprise for me usually is like when I've been sitting on a song for a while and we record it and it takes for a while for it to come out and I'm kind of like over it. And then when it comes out, people really like it because they're hearing it for the first time.
But your ears are dead. Like you're
yeah,
just
I've
like,
heard yeah. it too many times, you know, and I'm like, I'm on to other things. And so, you know, that's kind of the place that I like to be though. I really obviously like I'm an entertainer, so I feed off of positive reinforcement for sure. But
sure, yeah.
I do like to be, you know, off into the, or at like what I guess for all intents and purposes is the future, like working on new things or new ideas while the public is somewhat just hearing the older things for the first time. That's a good place to be. I like that place much better than, you know, when we would like some at certain points in our career, we would make a record and then just like stop, basically like go on, hang out and just kind of like, you know, and as I said, take our foot off the gas creatively, and it wouldn't lead to good things. So we kind of have we have an opposite policy now towards those things of just continually working, which I find to be much better. I will say though that like anytime we put out music and seeing that it resonates with anybody, that thrill never fades
right.
for me.
Me a devilish bitch. listening to Indie 101.5 CIOI.
You're listening to Steel City Music.
How do you deal with when you go out on the road? And of course, you know, we're going to chat about the new single, Bye Bye Big Bear, which is great. But when you go out on the road, do you find when you're playing a new album that the audience is like screaming for stuff off the past albums? So as you said, you know, this, I feed off of that. It's like a good energy. People want that. But do you find that sometimes you'll go back on the road and just play the old album in its entirety, plus the new album in its entirety? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, throwing some like the older albums back and then playing them just for fun.
Yeah. I mean, like, we definitely try and hit the gotta play songs every night or most nights. But I mean, like, we have a lot of